Welcome to The Watching Dead, the officially unofficial podcast for The Walking Dead on AMC. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 11, Episode 5, titled Out of the Ashes. Aaron, what'd you think of this episode?
I liked it. I think it's a good, you got to go back and get, keep up with what's going on in Alexandria. I needed more Commonwealth stuff. I don't know that everything worked as entirely as successful as I was hoping it was, but I think it did enough. I'm a little worried of some potential Morgulizing going on with Aaron and or Carol and combinations thereof.
I like those scenes.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm worried, but like what they're doing is kind of the thing that bothers me is I don't think Carol was at this point where she's ready to lead someone else from like. Because like the natural result of retort from Aaron is this: shut the fuck up. You have done whatever the fuck you wanted for as long as you wanted. A lot of this stuff is because of you, and I'm not going to hear any of this new hand wringing from you, Carol.
But that's
and I'm kind of disappointed that they didn't have Aaron actually just say that. Like, he came close, like you of all people, but like really unload on her.
Yeah,
because I don't feel like they've told me quite the story, or maybe they have, and we're just missing a conversation. But like I felt like Carol was realizing, because kind of like starting to come to grips with all the ways she's fucked up over the Whisperer arc, but she wasn't quite ready to be there and take responsibility for it. Maybe she has, and this is her doing it. But I felt like that's a little sloppy, Joe, and I'm a little worried that if this goes on, but I don't know. That's just me worrying. I don't think there's anything there yet. I want to get your reaction to that first. I'm sorry.
Okay. The reason I like those scenes is because it's not necessarily about like the solo nature of her. The unilateral nature of her decision making. It's about the thing that led to that. It's about the anger and the emotion that Aaron is feeling in the scene. And that's the part that I think Carol has started to get over, because she's still acting unilaterally. I mean, she's, Aaron's over there saying, hey, let's do this thing. And she's saying, nah, I'm going to go do this horse thing. That's still happening. But the emotional path that led her down, I think, is the one that hits the mark here. And so it worked for me. Out of everything in the episode, I think that's probably the best scene.
Huh. Well, it'd be interesting if we go through if I agree with that going through the recap. But it's like I said, it's nothing that like I thought was flashing red lights kind of warning.
Yeah.
Negan and Maggie, I think they're mostly doing that right. If you just ignore the stuff that they did wrong, like it's kind of where I think they should be.
Yeah.
What did you think of the action we got at the Commonwealth? I don't know if I like how jokey some of the stuff was.
It's a problem because like Princess is setting a tone there for sure. If you're talking about the jokey nature of it, you've got three of the craziest, most ridiculous, stupidest characters The Walking Dead has ever come up with in Princess, Ezekiel, and Eugene. It's gonna be kind of stupid and silly and jokey and hokey and all that stuff. Like, there's no way around it. They're not suddenly going to have some change of character that makes them all super serious. So
it's just wild, right? Because like that train station set, I felt like, oh, they're going to go for some kind of like high tense, untouchable sequence where it's like, there's like timing and there's tension, and then the Brer McCreary comedic hijinks music
and then
started
Eugene
playing.
Essentially doing this while he's like walking up the stairs. Nobody sees me.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, we're not going to get that. And like, I feel like they're leaning too far into the Kafka stuff way too soon. Like, I think that they're like, I was, hoping that they're, I mean, obviously I feel like the Commonwealth has to be evil, right? Cause like, I don't know, I guess maybe The Walking Dead is going to go out with, you know, Rick's spiritual successors and his group being the terrorists that bring down a benevolent, essentially a better, more benevolent version of what they had going in Alexandria. Maybe they've got the courage to tell that story, but I don't think so. And if I feel like they're letting the cat out of the bag way early. And also, like, there's some things that just don't make sense. Like, is Yumiko's brother going to just be down with the dystopian fascist dictatorship that lets him bake cakes, even though he's a neurosurgeon? Why is this utopia got a surgeon? I don't know why I put the brain on. Why they got a surgeon working in a cake shop?
I think because they don't know he's a surgeon. I think he's never told them that. Yeah.
Why? But okay, so like there's a couple questions I have that, and then also like if the fines for disobedience are so high, why did Eugene's girlfriend, is her name Stephanie?
Yeah, it is.
Why does she so blasé go along? Like, this is the kind of thing where it's like, you know, I got the feeling that like what she's doing is allow them to essentially use the company postage machine. Like, yeah, you can send a couple postcards through. What's an extra 50 cents? But it's like, oh, no, you might be executed or exiled for this crime.
Yeah.
It never it felt like a light hijinks thing, not like a capital crime. And there's a clash of that I felt like probably I would rather not be there, to be honest.
I do wish they had told us what Stephanie's potential sentence was here, because they tell us what the newcomer's potential sentence is, and it's banishment. And yeah, 100, like they'll send you hundreds of miles away. I don't know if they're shooting them out in a cannon or what, but like.
Right.
It did seem pretty severe for the newcomers. I wonder if it's not nearly as severe for the citizens. I wonder if it's.
But they're also, this is the social commentary, right? Like, you know, like you don't have full rights of the citizen. You're just asylum seeker. So like they are definitely trying to say something about, you know, what obligations societies that are better off have to ones that maybe through no fault of their own are worse off. How you can integrate and assimilate various people that are traumatized and bloodthirsty. I'm just talking about in the Walking Dead world. They're traumatized and bloodthirsty or have a skewed view of authority and rules because they've been out here versus like that stuff is interesting, but I feel like they're shying away from that in favor of things that aren't that interesting. But it's also possible that this is all still an elaborate part of the test. Of, you know, like they first hit you with like, you know, like what is Stephanie's job? If was she like, was that always an illicit use of community resources when she's having those long conversations with Eugene? Or is she supposed to be kind of some kind of outreach? I don't know, because like, and since I don't know, whether this is just part of the gag, like, you know, Stephanie lures them in, or maybe they've got a guy. For people, for the ladies and the gay bros out there to lure them in like a siren, and then they get them and they process them and then they test them. You know, like it's like you said, you don't have a large group, but how quickly are you going to want to run to the radio to tell? You know, it's like, yeah. So is it a setup? I don't know. I just wish it was like 50% less humor, 50% more seriousness going on in these scenes.
And at the end, they tease, you know, some. Upper echelon of the hierarchy here, right, that is somehow interested in them beyond their forays into hobbyist
post-apocalyptic radio. A post-apocalyptic Saul Goodman steps onto the scene,
essentially. Yeah,
that's what it feels like to me.
A little bit. I don't know, he's clearly important, right? But
yeah, if you're a day one immigrant to the Commonwealth and you've commandeered the official radio, you don't need a criminal lawyer. You need a criminal lawyer.
Right.
And that's what this guy is.
Yeah. So I we'll see where they go with that. But overall, I liked the episode. I thought it was pretty solid.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
A couple of complaints, but not much.
Yeah, I'm curious to see more. Like every plot line I'm essentially engaged in thus far.
Yeah, I don't think there was anything just blatantly stupid. So that's a bonus.
I kind of like that there's still a Whisperer band out there that is kicking around for good or evil.
Makes sense.
That was interesting too, yeah.
I'm hoping they don't make that a huge part of the coming season. I think it's a neat idea for it to just be there, but I also don't want the Whisperers to be any kind of threat to them whatsoever.
I don't think so. I think it's going to be a morality barometer for our crew.
Makes sense.
Like, it's going to contrast our crew versus the Reavers versus the Commonwealth and versus the, you know, because the Whispers are going to also be, as they're wont to do, like, what Alpha said was right. You guys are no better. I think how we, because these guys are, I think you're supposed to understand, these guys are to Alexandria as Alexandria is to the Commonwealth. You know,
yeah,
there's no reason to take them in. There's every reason to be distrustful for them. And I think that's we're going to draw comparisons between how these people are treated and how, or, I mean, I guess there's no antagonism between Alexandria and these, except for, you know, we've already got there one day and we're lying and cheating them and swindling them. So, sure. But I think that's what the role they're going to play.
You know, if I did have to pick something in this episode that I didn't like, I'd probably say it's the ending of this episode. I think it's oddly anticlimactic. They mention that Connie's out there and then Carol's like, I gotta go, let's go find her right now, I gotta fix my past mistakes. And Aaron's like, that'll probably wait till morning, let's go back to Alexandria. And she says okay, and they head back. Now Carol being Carol, I think there's basically zero chance that she gets all the way back to Alexandria before going off on her own mission. But
yeah, there's some significant looks that she's given in response. Yeah.
I just didn't think this was a really great way to end the episode, but I don't know. It was fine.
It's a little Fellowship of the Ring where, you know, Aragorn's getting everybody up to go save our friend on this long, perilous side journey that was not the journey that we're supposed to take on. So I think,
and then it just ends.
I don't know. Yeah. And then it just ends. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, speaking of ending, let's end this preamble and get into the recap, why don't we?
Sure.
Well, let's take a break real quick first.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday, covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
All right, we start off with Aaron and his girl, Gracie, walking through the woods. They're surrounded by whisperers. Gracie runs off. Aaron is killed. Surprise, surprise, it's a dream. Bet you didn't see that coming. Why do shows do this? Why? Look, there's nothing you can do in a dream sequence that won't immediately give away that it's a dream sequence and reduce any investment I have in it to zero.
I hear what you're saying, but on the other hand, I think dream sequences are best for telling interior states of characters. Like, they're used to great effect. Sure. The Sopranos, man. I just finished season 5 a couple days ago, and they had like one of the best dream sequences I've ever seen in that show late season. So I think that's what it's doing. It's telling that, like, if, in case you've recalled, Aaron has been going through a little arc where Aaron was like the moral center of our character. Aaron has been deeply shaken by the whisperers. Like, he's the one that always brought people new to the community, and he was stood in opposition to Michonne's kind of isolationist stance. Michonne kind of talked him into it. So he's a lot harder of a character. And then he kind of started to come back from that arc, and he had that shocking situation with Gabriel in the T-1000 that they reminded us of this. Honestly, I thought this scene is also great for all the callbacks. I mean, it went all the way back to the wolves.
Wolves, right? I said whispers, yeah. But it's a whole bunch of people. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You had the guy with the W carved on his head. So I think it just reminds us, because it's been a while since we've had, it's been since the mid of the pandemic episodes, which is getting on like 8, 9, 10 episodes ago, since we remembered like what the fuck Aaron was. So like, yeah, this dream shows him like he's worried about his family. Like several times he'll be like, Gracie is starving because of these assholes. Gracie is homeless because of these assholes. And this is just all the sacrifices he's made along the way, kind of like manifesting in his all this. It's the sum of, I wrote in my notes that this is the sum of all his fears.
Sure.
You know, coming all at once, and he can do nothing to stop him.
In a very stylistic kind of visual here, they're doing a lot with this stuff lately. In this scene, it's all like very red leaves inside of an inky black forest area.
It reminded me a lot of the psychedelic visuals from like Mandy or Color Out of Space, the Walking Dead video game. Honestly, it had a lot of that aesthetic.
The Telltale game,
yeah, they like to do this kind of like trippy shit too.
Yeah, and Walking Dead hasn't traditionally done it, though I think in the last couple seasons they've really stepped up their game there, and a dream sequence allows you to do that without it feeling artificial, though they've done it in real world situations before that doesn't feel artificial either.
Is
it a wooden hand that he puts on in the morning? Does he have like a morning hand and a battle hand and a building hand? And
I don't know, because like that prop does not look good up close. Let's just leave it at that, because I couldn't tell if it's a Pinocchio carved hand. I couldn't tell if it's supposed to be a lightly rusted Tin Man hand. This prop is best admired from the middle distance, I think.
I like to think he has just a whole gallery of hands that he can choose from. Sure.
We know he's got
like
the mace,
Batman,
right?
Suits. Right, yeah, he does have the mace.
He's got.
He probably has a hook.
He's got a feather duster. He's got he's got a pancake spatula attached. He's multifunctional. Yeah.
Oh, does he do the tongs?
A pasta machine. That pasta machine. Wait, remember that? He's got an arm that just makes pasta.
Yeah.
Like a Play-Doh Fun Factory.
Roller? Like.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, it just comes out the other. It's just like he puts it and it just comes out the end. Shoots out the stump.
Oh, yeah. Like the Play-Doh. Right. So then Jerry wakes up in the morning for a piss, and he finds a walker inside the walls. What the fuck, people? He wakes everybody up. Aaron sends Gracie down to the basement while the others run out to deal with a whole bunch of walkers just rushing in through a hole in the wall, and they manage to get it sealed off again. What happened to their lookouts? I saw one guy got eaten, but sound the alarm
before that happens. I guess I can't fault them for this, because how do you set up? I will fault them a little bit. You set up by like just having to show the zombies milling around. You show that there's lookouts, but because of how big Alexandria is versus how many people they've got, they can't watch it. But I think this is the problem with Alexandria kind of being hypothetically Schrodinger's destroyed, because they're telling a story of the having way too many mouths to feed, big man Jerry here stepping through a minefield of sleeping people in his house. Mm-hmm. So like, okay, the walls are weak, but you got tons of manpower.
Right.
So why aren't there lookouts on the walls? But on the other hand, most of the warriors are dead. They're all civilians. They're not good at, but I feel like they need that. This is, they're trying to tell stories based on the stories they haven't quite sold to me.
Yeah.
And I got all these giant problems. Like, you know, how did these walls get fucked up?
Mm-hmm.
Like, did the whispers hose them down with some kind of acid? Like what did they do to this thing? Like, even if they stacked like brush against it and set it on fire, I don't think steel walls would melt in those conditions. I don't know. That's my take on it. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm with you. There's some nebulous like destruction of Alexandria that happened that we never really got to see. And so now we don't really know the state. And so every time they introduce something, I have a lot of questions. I'm not necessarily saying it doesn't work, but I just don't feel like I'm grounded in the scenario that they've created here. But I feel like the writers think they are.
Yeah. And they're also backfilling stuff. Like today we got the additional information. I think Aaron is saying, or maybe it was Carol, where they're like, it was Matt. Like, they didn't just come in to Alexandria. They actually at some unspecified point came back and set the place on fire and burnt the crops and fucked. So we didn't see that. No. We just saw the initial, like what was, it seemed like a tactical victory for Alexandria, where Beta led the horde in there to destroy it. And there was no one to destroy, so just kind of milled around and left. Now, obviously that'll hurt the crops a little bit, but like, how did they fuck with the walls, man? Did they have like 20 battery powered angle grinders to like cut the supports and stuff? Cause they didn't tell that story. And I feel like they realized it. So they had this one line of dialogue where, I guess after the total collapse of the whispers, there's enough nucleus that they just wanted to do one last fuck you and came back and did. But again, I don't think they did the story very well.
No, they haven't. And it's having, follow on consequences in all of these episodes. And it's kind of too late to go back and like explain it. Right. I mean,
yeah.
It's just something I'm going to have to get
over. Would have been a great thing you could have done in the COVID episodes, but you were limited to how many people you could shoot. So it sucks. I did really like Jerry's morning routine, getting up and like just this big dude tiptoeing through these sleeping bags and stuff on the floor like it's a minefield, and him like, you know, taking his piss and just kind of casually noticing the zombie shuffling down the street. I liked all that stuff. Grace having a zombie whistle that like she can hide in the basement, but if they're breaking in, she can presumably, Aaron will hear it and come running. There's some cool little details, and I'm certain that whistle will be dramatically important somewhere down the stretch here.
Yeah I assume so. Then we go over to the Commonwealth and we get an orientation video for the community. Then the group there are assigned their jobs. Eugene gets high school teacher, I think. Princess gets retail clerk. Ezekiel gets is in animal control in some position. And Yumiko just gets an invitation to go talk about future opportunities with the Office of State Affairs. Then Eugene tries to remind everybody, hey, we're not here to start a new life. We're here to get help for the people in our old life. Ezekiel agrees to take it up with the case supervisor, and Princess joins him. And then Eugene goes to meet Stephanie, and Yumiko asks about her sister.
Yeah, this guy who's like welcoming to the Commonwealth is Mr. Hornsberg, I think.
Hornsby. Didn't they say that's what? I think.
Hornsby, you're right, Hornsby.
Yeah.
And when I was watching this again, I noticed that, because I originally thought that the person who wrote Yumiko will be this guy and is all going to tie together somehow. But it's different. The guy who signed this letter saying, I want to talk to you from the State Department, his name was Widgeway.
Oh.
I'm wondering who these various powerful people, like we hear about this, the Milton family, led by Governor Pam Milton, that everyone credits to this society thriving. We met this, where we saw this Edward Widgeway, who is trying to recruit Yumiko to some kind of State Department thing. and we met the Hornsby guy, who is what I am calling the Better Call Saul, the Slip and Jimmy of the show. Because he feels, I mean, this, what'd you think of the commercial? What'd you think of the orientation video?
Hey, I'm not sure why they're doing this through VHS, but maybe get some digital media in here. Like, you've got a functioning society. You've got fucking cakes coming at your ass. Maybe get a CD or something that can perfectly recreate this film every time. Because your equipment's failing. Your tapes are failing. You need to fix that. What are you going to do 20 years from now when you're showing the same shitty VHS tape to new recruits? But the video, like the content of the video itself, it feels ominous in that way that like it's too good to be true, right? That they're showing you in the North Korea, showing you all the good parts of North Korea kind of way that we talked about last episode. That's what it feels like to me.
I felt like there's a tonal problem where this felt like something from Ryan Murphy's American Horror Story.
Sure.
Like something about the aesthetic, something about the VHS thing, something about it. Just there's a lack of seriousness to it. And again, a little bit heavy handed with the menace lurking beneath the what appears to be kind of nicey nice.
So this is just communism, right? Like everybody's getting assigned a job here. There is a social strata here, a class system, sure,
which might just be communism.
There's a class system at work here too. This is a very hierarchical thing, and you can see it when Yumiko asks about her letter and the guy's like dismissive, you're fucking super, your guy will take care of all this, don't talk to me. And she says no, it's from the Office of State Affairs, and he's like oh yes ma'am, I can help you with that, absolutely. There's obvious divide,
a class thing. And it's working. No, you're right. But also, like, I just felt there's a little bit too pat, like, animal control? You guys got 50,000 people and you've got animal control openings? Like, I felt like, and like, you know, what's her face's princess's retail? Like, I don't know. It felt there's something, there's something a little off about the world building. Like, you know, like if you're an educator, you know, like put you in a high school to be a science teacher or whatever, that kind of makes sense. But like, oh, you tame tigers or whatnot, we'll put you in animal control. You used to check things out, keep, like, why wouldn't she be sorted into like sanitation or just like any kind of manual labor? Because retail is essentially unskilled labor, right?
You know?
Customer relations or something like that, but it just felt like it's weird that that's like this is the needs that this have, and they neatly map into their pre, and that's what it makes me think, like, is this just another test or another layer of the weird bureaucracy mental games they're playing?
I guess it could be, because it doesn't make much sense for a community that most certainly has needs at any given moment to simply slot you in based on, because it's luck of the draw, right? Who you're going to find in the zombie apocalypse. They could have 6,000 bakers. Well, you can't have 6,000 bakers on staff in a community of 50,000. So are they all going to be bakers? Do you just slot them in where they fit in or what? Totally right there.
The Surgeon Brothers, the other thing that threw me about that is like, did they have so many surgeons that they're just like, okay, well, you know, we're just going to, you know, I got 50,000 people. There's only so many hearts that need to be operated on. So fucking go bake bread.
I mean, that's probably
George
true.
Retires or Mary dies. So I don't know how much I want the show to actually sit down and explain to society or just kind of show, but I'm worried that like what they're showing me is dumb. That's the thing. Always the fear of The Walking Dead is like, you know, am I setting myself up by thinking, oh, they're doing something cooler? And it's like, no, it's just this. No, I don't know. But there's something artificial and evil about the society, and I feel like they're letting the cat out of the bag too soon, but who knows?
Yeah. The artificiality and the evilness could just be coming from the fact that they don't know how to tell the story very well, but we'll see.
I do like Eugene constantly, like, you know, even though he's here and he's achieved his primary objective, he's got enough decency that he's like, look, we can't get sidetracked that we forget about plan A, which is helping Alexandria. Yeah. I like that he's always kind of bringing things back. It's kind of weird that the rest of this is maybe except for Princess. It's kind of weird especially Ezekiel is kind of like, fucking cool, I get to work with animals. I mean, like, they've all forgot why they're here. Like, Yumiko's like, I got to see my brother. That makes maybe more sense. But like, I thought King Ezekiel would be a little bit more mission oriented, too.
Well, Zeke's on a suicide mission. Zeke's not getting out of this one way or another. True. So he's probably just like, I want to pet some tigers before I die.
Although it, I don't like, what is his cancer status? Because they have medical care here. They have surgeons that are baking bread. Like they mentioned that he had medical.
Him? Oh, he
hasn't
did
told
he?
Them, but wouldn't they like, wouldn't they check out that giant goiter on his neck?
Yeah, probably.
I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I would imagine it's fairly simple to tell the difference between like a tumor and something benign.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, cancer is not like it's a disease that spreads. So maybe that's a low risk. I don't know.
I don't know. Did you get the impression that Yumiko knew who Pamela Milton is based on the way she says her name in this scene? Because I did.
I got something, but I didn't. Okay. There was nothing else that kind of like, there's nothing else that kind of like made me take note of it more. But yeah, I did notice that there was a reaction.
Okay. Yeah, I couldn't quite read it, but something.
This family, it'd probably be important, though. They'll be turned out to be important before the fall. So,
yeah, that's what I'm guessing.
Yeah.
All right. Back in Alexandria, walkers continue to batter the fence. Their horse jerky supply is getting low, so they decide to make a run to Hilltop to get some of the blacksmith's old tools and maybe find some food. Rosita suggests that they at least have a plan B to abandon Alexandria. But Aaron's definitely wanting to try the Hilltop plan first.
I first of all, I really like them spreading the load out to the walls by, you know, banging on strong areas. Like that's neat. That's cool. It gives, like, you know, explains, because like my next question is like, well, this is such a shambles. How is it not falling constantly? Well, they're smart.
Well, I loved that right up until they explained it, and I'm like, I got it. I don't need you to Rosita to come up and say, hey, every character on staff here, where you are banging on the walls for this very. Just show me the thing they're doing and I'll figure out why they're doing it. And yeah, they did it.
What kind of tools does The Walking Dead think you need to fix like gross metal fabricating problems like this? Like, oh man, if we just had the perfect screwdriver, a pair of pliers, we'd be home here.
Yeah,
like,
some fire tongs.
Like did the blacksmith have like a fucking rivet gun? Did he have like...
Why would he need that in a wooden walled society?
Did he have a TIG welder? Like, why? Yeah, I just think that
go to Reg's stash, dig through Reg's closet and see what tools he had. Because
we get Bob
Vila
as a executive overseer of like their construction, because like they're just not telling the story of like we don't got the tools or the material. Like, well, I don't know, man. Like, you can't fast like this stuff is. Seems like you'd need basic gear or gear that's way more advanced than the blacksmith has.
Yeah, gear that originated in Alexandria because that's where the walls were built. Unless Beta was in there like, grab that rivet gun and throw it out into the woods because they're going to need that to rebuild the wall. Oh, yeah, you see that that sheet metal over there? Yeah, let's take that back to the cave. Get that out of here. Mm-hmm. Were they orchestrating and how? If they had thousands and thousands of walkers around them at all times... Were they picking and choosing what to destroy?
Very slowly, you gotta moan and groan and make sure your guts are applied, and
this is why they didn't show us the destruction of Alexandria, because it would have looked ridiculous.
But they need tools. They need some broken and burnt up tools from Hilltop, or this walls is going to be a shambles for the rest of the show's existence, and can't have that. There's even talk of abandoning Alexandria because it's so fucked up.
Yeah, for sure. Then Maggie and Negan are fighting off walkers. Negan wants to know why Maggie hasn't killed him yet, but she doesn't really have an answer. Is there anything to talk about in this scene?
It's a bit of a trope, but like the whole, you know, throwing a knife right over your head and it sinks into a zombie sneaking up behind you. I'll let that use of stealth zombie. I'll allow it. It's fine.
It's pretty far off. Then they arrive at Hilltop and see the devastation. This is Aaron's group and Carol's group, and they have to put down their zombified friends. I want to say this is the first time we've ever seen a single fly on a single walker, and I thought it was a really cool touch.
I thought that they did a really good job of showing what a sad, dispiriting job this would be. That, like, it's already like, imagine going back to like your burnt out home. To like scavenge something you need at your refugee camp, and also all your dead relatives are there trying to kill you. All your friends and people you loved, like, it would The only thing to make this better is if we actually knew any of these characters.
I was going to say,
oh, fuck, there's that guy or there's that person or there. But like, yeah, it's if it was that, it would have been even better. But like they did. I thought they spent the exact right amount of time, like just showing how just fucking miserable and like, you know, like these people are already pretty down bad. This is just gutting them. It's and they, especially Aaron, the one that they're, you know, trying to focus on. It's really, really kind of darkening his spirit.
Yeah, but how he's also sort of able to put it to the side and continue with the mission.
Got
to
do for Gracie, man. What are you going to do?
There are more walkers on the walls of Alexandria that keep coming up. Judith is teaching the children to use swords, and she sees some shitty preteens. They're getting younger, these shitty teens. Younger
every
day.
We've run out of shitty hilltop teens. Now we have the 13-year-old crowd. Shitty preteens.
They're being shitty on the wall, so she goes over to stop them, and they bully her until she puts a blade to one of their necks.
Gut this kid. Fuck this kid. I hate these kids on sight. I hope they all get bit and die, or I hope Judith, you know, got their neck giving up their fucking life's blood. I'm done. Done with these goddamn children of the corn apocalypse. Fuck them all. They made Judith cry. It's not cool.
I agree.
And man, what a fucking beast Judith is. I'm going to have to learn this young actor's name because she's doing, you know, I mean, I don't know. She's crying. But I feel like convincing kid crying, especially when you're dealing with like, you know, like this nuanced stuff about her brother and her dad and also on top of being bullied. And she's like, you know, you can tell she's always been the mature one that plays by the rules, does the right things, been rewarded for it. And now she's got these fuckers that don't care about anything. It's good. And I hate these kids. I love Judith. They need to die. I'm rooting for these children's death.
I am too. The shitty preteens are somehow worse than the shitty teens. But
yeah.
Okay.
I wish I had a Walkman. I wish Daryl had recorded what I can only assume is their shitty older brother getting eaten to death because of his act of cowardice and maliciousness. And I want them to show that to those kids every night before they go to bed so they know what the hell happens to little shits like them.
Apparently, Kaylee Fleming.
If Carl and Henry are still alive, we wouldn't be putting up with this shit.
Oh, no, of course not. They learned their lessons a long time ago the hard way. These kids are spoiled rotten.
Got him, Judith.
Oh, God, what are the kids in the Commonwealth going to be like? If this is the hard life that you have in Alexandria, turning these kids into little shits, what is the soft, cushy bakery life going to do to them?
I don't know. They're either going to be even worse or they're going to be full on Nazi youth where like they look like they're model citizens, except for God. The thing they're really passionate about is persecuting minorities. There's no middle ground. It's going to be tragic.
Kaylee Fleming is the actor's name who's portraying Judith, and she's great. Does she look like a young Hayden Panettiere to you?
I don't know who that is.
The cheerleader from Heroes.
She looks like a young my niece, my sister's kid, and down to like the cowboy boots and the Western affectation. She's a horse girl. Yeah, I mentioned this years ago that I really identified with this person because she reminds me so much of my niece, and I get a kick out of that. And these guys bullying her.
Fuck him.
It was way too early in the morning when I watched this episode for me to put up with this shit.
All right. Maggie and Negan hit the suburbs. They make it to the outpost and they begin waiting. And Negan is antsy and wants to leave. But Maggie's still focused on Meridian and he tries to convince her to wait no later than sundown to call off the mission. I don't know. It doesn't really seem to work. There's no talking Maggie out of this suicide pact she's got with
and her
Meridian.
Faith is going to be rewarded. I mean, the thing is like this is a necessary scene, but it's also completely rote. Yeah. You know, by it's yeah. This is every fucking, you know, game over, man, bug out. Versus we got to do the mission kind of discussion you've ever seen in a war film or a disaster film, and you know, we got the good guy and the bad guy playing the roles and checking the boxes. We'll see where this goes in the scenes to come.
Yeah. Yumiko goes into a Commonwealth pastry shop that's fully stocked, and she finds her brother, Tomi, cooking bacon cakes. Yeah, that's it.
It's weird because they had Yumiko playing this as if, like, when she walked in and she smelled and she started smiling. I guess it's just a lady who hasn't had pies and cakes for a while.
Yeah.
Except for Alexander, kind of famous for their fresh, they use that as a torture method. Look at all of our fresh baked produce and our jams and jelly. Like, they couldn't make a cake in Alexandria for kids. I don't know. She walks in and I thought she was like, oh, this is a nostalgic smile because, like, I know my brother's cakes or whatever. Mm. And they really threw me at the surgeon stuff because I'm like, well, maybe she just is like, oh, I haven't smelled pies for a while. But they played it as if I, you know, and then when the guy popped out and was like, can I help you? I'm like, oh, there's her brother. And she's like, oh, I'm looking for my brother. I don't know. I thought it was weird. What did you think?
I didn't have any of the weirdness necessarily. I think the surgeon stuff was. It's there to be kind of a question mark on their past relationship. And I will talk about that when we get there. Cause I think they're hinting at a lot of backstory between these two and stuff that Magna has kind of been pointing out about Yumiko as well in past episodes that didn't work cause we hated Magna, but I think we might like this Tomy guy a little bit better. Hopefully. Although there's no fucking way this guy's British, right? Based on his accent, it's not good.
Well, it kind of came and went throughout the episode,
right?
Like this, the early scenes, I thought this might be a Kevin Costner where he's like, hey, I spent 5 minutes with the Boston accent. You guys believe it, right? You guys are buying into, you know, I'm Robin Hood. I've thrown a couple ye olds in here. I can go back to my regular kind of. Yeah. I don't know. I feel like
the dude's
it.
Born in St. Paul, Minnesota. Yeah. This is just a bad English accent. All right.
He's like me. He can do it for a couple sentences and it just kind of right. Tokyo drifts. That wasn't anything about him being Asian, by the way.
Well, he's pretending to be British, so I would hope not. Yeah.
I'm saying his accent is sliding. It's the back end stepping out. You know, there's a lot of smoke coming from the back wheels of his accents. What I'm saying.
Gotcha. So where the hell are we?
Picking through blacksmith tools, apparently.
Oh, right. The hilltop. They see walkers being herded by whisperers and they kill the walkers and demask the whisperer. And apparently it's a dude named Keith that Lydia knows. I don't know.
Yeah, they're doing some layered storytelling here with Aaron that, like, you know, he's a little bit of a doomer now. And Jerry's got to, you know, like, look at all this. There's nothing standing. He's like, come on, dude, we're still standing.
Yeah.
And I like I said, I think this Whisperer group has got some interesting potential.
Yeah. Eugene and Stephanie are getting ice cream back at the Commonwealth and they take the tour, just kind of walking through, looking at stuff. He's taken with the place, but he can't stay. And he asks Stephanie how to cut through the red tape to get in touch with his friends or to help his friends. She's got nothing, but then offers him a way to talk on the town radio. Normally, it'll take 2 weeks. There's this whole thing where Zeke runs up and says 5 weeks to see the boss. They're painting a picture here of shit moves real slow in the Commonwealth because of the bureaucracy.
Ice cream on demand, but you got to wait in line for toilet paper. This is going to be really weird shit.
Yeah. And then Stephanie says, yeah, we'll go use the radio right now. And Red Guard sees them, which is key.
What is the deal with the lady that bops up and gets like a dozen cones and one of them's Rocky Road? And like, there's like,
I don't know.
Is she someone like executive kid? And this is her first role getting because like the camera loves her. And it's like, look at this character, look at her but like, as far as I can tell, it goes nowhere.
And he asks about the Rocky Road and she just gives him this look that's like,
yeah,
fuck
like, okay,
off.
Weirdo. Creep. Yeah. Yeah.
Why?
She jumps the line, gets her pre-made 12 cones. Yeah. I don't
know. Are these going to Pamela Milton? Are these Pamela Milton's cones and yeah, she cannot be bothered with the
if
rabble?
This is their way to start an Animal Farm tale. I'm worried because. Yeah. Maybe some people get one ice cream cone and not of their choosing and other people get 12 Rocky Roads.
I think
That's a cutting commentary on classism in today's society. I tell you what, that's what fucking pisses me off about society. The unequal distribution of ice cream. We need to seize the means of Cold Stone Creamery.
These cones were definitely unevenly distributed. Hers was much smaller than Eugene's, which I appreciated. But then the big old lick that Eugene takes off this thing.
He fucking made love to this cone. Man, that's an unorthodox lick. That's a guy who
loved it.
He's inhaling the cone.
Then we go back to Alexandria, where the shitty preteens are trashing Judith's house. They claim they didn't do it and they leave. And the younger kids offer to help her rebuild what was broken, which is this. I think we've seen this in previous seasons.
Yeah, this is where, like, when her Carl knew he was dying and he had that one day where he spent with his family, he and Judith did this as handprints on their deck. And this was after post time jump. This was like a centerpiece over their staircase.
How young was Judith?
So young, like 3, 4.
Because later, like younger. In this scene, Rosita comes by and is like trying to cheer her up and saying, you know, this is, they're talking about the people they love that they've lost and how her parents taught her to get through these tough times when she was possibly alone. And she talks about Carl as if she knew Carl and was like, they had a relationship, but she was so young. I don't know how she would remember anything about Carl.
I felt like that's something they should have leaned into when she's like, you'll always remember how much they love you. She's like, every day I feel like I'm forgetting what Carl looked like or something like that.
Yeah, because they
could have leaned in that this is like, I need this. But the thing that really bothered me, why aren't the adults trying to find out who did this? This is borderline a hate crime. Like, to destroy this, this is a shrine to a dead person. What the hell? And Rosita's like, oh, we'll just fix it. The Rosita I know would want crime and punishment to happen.
Yeah.
Like, and again, I get it. I want to see these kids gutted. Maybe that's extreme. Mm-hmm. Maybe I shouldn't be the one that's meting out justice. But like, I feel like that's important if you're an adult and there's been some kind of violation like this, whether it's between siblings or what, like you got to get to the bottom of it and take it seriously or else like, what do you tell? Like, you know what? Don't ever care about anything because someone can destroy it and there's no consequences, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. Rosita's not really hitting all the high notes here. She's also saying that she can help Judith rebuild this thing because she's really good at fixing things. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, well, then why are the walls so fucking busted still? If that's the kind of botch job you plan on doing with this board, I'll do it myself, Rosita.
She's good at fixing things with like wood glue, you know.
Okay.
Cold rolled steel, that's a little tougher. If only she had Gorilla Glue, she'd be good to go.
Sure. Then we move over to the Hilltop again. This episode jumps around a lot, where the group interrogates Keith, the Whisperer. He claims he's the last of his kind and that he's the good Whisperer. Lydia stands up for him, but everybody else decides to lock him up until they decide what to do with him. Unfortunately, then they find out the cellar is already full of Whisperers, and they find Nabila's scarf, which means that these were definitely Whisperers in Alexandria. And then the Whisperers kind of know the jig's up, so they attack. Some manage to run off, but Aaron, I thought killed Keith, but he doesn't kill Keith.
I thought Keith gutted Aaron. Then I thought Aaron for sure killed Keith.
He says it's my turn and what? And he's got a knife.
I was surprised to find, nothing. Actually, none of those things happened. I did like Jerry getting his blood up when he like finds his wife's headscarf and like, you know, these people burnt my fucking homes. Like, these are not the good ones. And also that this guy lied about everything.
Yeah.
Like, it's really easy to get onto the Aaron train here and be all aboard for summary execution.
Mm-hmm. Go back to the Commonwealth. Eugene's group sneaks into the communications building and they are so conspicuous. This is a comedy. I don't know how you could not notice them sneaking something here.
Yeah, and again, I feel like it's a bad tonal clash. I understand because you've got essentially fundamentally goofy characters, and you're trying to, but like the stakes do not match. Like, I think it's a bummer to watch a person like Princess fuck up everything and get people killed. Mm-hmm. Like, Princess is a hilarious character, but if she's like doing her shtick and people are dying or getting imprisoned and enslaved in the background, it's not funny.
Right.
You know,
I guess
it's
I don't
only
know
funny
what
the stakes aren't high
were yet. So maybe you could laugh at this scene, but in retrospect, it's a little bit more.
Yeah.
Down note. And then we go to Yumiko, who's chatting with Tomi about how he got here. She mentions that he's a surgeon, which makes him a little jumpy, I think, because he prefers baking. He asks her not to ruin it for him, and she asks if the Commonwealth would be willing to help her people, and he's like, it's possible. I don't know, maybe. I think this scene is, there's a lot of subtext here in this scene that they they're starting to lay out a history for these two characters. And that is, I think, pretty good because of the stuff we've seen with Magna previously. There was a very like strong Yumiko is controlling in a weird way of other she's people's lives. Very much a pusher, expects a lot from the people she's around. And Magna was on her case about that. Never feeling like she was living up to Yumiko's expectations of her. And I think the same thing you're going to see is true of Tomy, and that he was sort of pushed maybe by his entire family, maybe just by Yumiko, into being a surgeon. And he was very successful and good at it, but he didn't really want to do it. And so now he's gotten a second lease on life in a sort of way, by becoming a baker. I 100%
got all that too.
And he hasn't told, I think the key is he hasn't told, the Commonwealth what his actual skill set is, and so they've assigned him as if, you know, he was always doing his dream job of baking.
I have a problem with that because like it makes him, if that's true, and I think that's a good reading of it, that's what I got from it too. If it's true, it does a lot of damage to what I feel about his character off the bat, because it's one thing if you drop out of med school and disappoint your family and you retire to be a potter in San Francisco and you're happy. It's another thing when you're in a post-apocalyptic environment where people are living and dying to zombies and you're a person with a very vital knowledge and you're just like, well, you know, my best life is baking. Like, well, fuck you, man. Like, I don't know that you like what I maybe get to make that call, but I also get to decide that I think you're an asshole because you're hiding your light under. Yeah. I mean, and maybe it sucks, but like it's a zombie apocalypse. It's hard all around.
Except I do hope for Yumiko makes this behind, case to him at some point. Yeah, and, you know, maybe probably. He pushes back because she always does this, you know,
but boy, man, my appetite for like wanting to see both sides of that is not high. Cause I really didn't like come it down when it came on the to side. Because like the thing is like there's ways you could tell that story to have Yumiko look like she's a crazy person. Uh-huh. But Magna, miss, I'm stealing half of the group supplies and squirreling because I don't trust anybody. I'm gonna like you are not the one that's like you're just hassling people because they won't follow the rules, lady. Yeah. Like she's not the one to make that case. And neither is this guy, Mr. I can save people's lives, but I'd rather fucking make their asses bigger because they're eating too much pie and cake. I don't know. I don't know if they're aware of that, but that's like, if this is the case, I'm going to kind of feel this guy is a Magna type. And by Magna type, I mean, is a character I don't take seriously. When she stands up and makes an impassioned plea to the group, it's kind of like Eugene doing it. Like my baseline is, well, you're a fucking idiot. Mm-hmm. So no one should listen to you. And when they do, it always throws me. Cause I'm like, well, wait, don't you all know that they're an idiot? So.
Right. Yeah, we'll see.
Maybe he's the baby brother and he's kind of a fuck up, but he's a, I don't know. Yeah, we'll see.
I assumed he was a baby brother. I don't know why though. Probably because they're dynamic.
I tell you, the thing is like, man, if they had gone for a little bit more tense, breaking into the communication scene rather than this is just kind of like a naughty lark, it would have fed in so well to the next scene because like, is this place as good as we're led to believe? Oh, it's better. Here, anything's possible. As long as you follow the rules, smash cut to rule breaking. Yours, but it's almost played like a joke, like a sitcom. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I felt like it could have been more effective with a little bit more tension.
All right, next up, Princess stalls Red Guard as he's about to enter the building. Kind of, you know, thanks him for giving the $2 bill back, which I think is a pretty big thing considering what they do with cash here.
It plays like. I never saw a romance or even a liking between these two characters. It goes both ways.
Yeah, no.
But, you know, that was that $2 bill is important to Princess. Mm-hmm. If you recall, it was from her first paycheck. It represents her first adult money. It's Uncle Scrooge's. His first
lucky dime.
Yep. You know, it has a lot of psychological importance. I actually have the very first check that was given to me for a creative work. And I got it like 10 years before I started Bald Move, and its little frame was like, hey, you know, the shit I did in the free time was worth it to somebody. So I get that. And it's cool of Mercer to give it back to her. But I don't know. Like I said, this kind of comes out of nowhere. The fact that there's either a potential romance or a mutual respect. I did not see coming.
Gotcha. Let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, as a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
All right, we go back over to the hilltop where Aaron tries to get information out of Keith, and Keith tells them the dead are better than them. So Aaron feeds him to the walker, kind of. He feeds his hand to the walker and says, hey, you got time. Mm-hmm. If we cut that thing off, you can save yourself. You just got to give up the Whisperer's locations. Lydia's not interested in watching Keith being tortured, so she runs off. Carol steps in and tells a very angry Aaron how losing Henry took her down this very dark path, and he doesn't want to go down the same one. Trust me. I like this scene quite a bit.
Yeah, Carol's had a lot of experience. This is like the third different dark path she's gone down that led to a lot of people dying and unilateral action that she came to. So she knows what she's talking about, Aaron.
For sure.
But Aaron's got a good point, too. Like, I like the fact that, like, you know, Gracie, you know, is going hungry. She's homeless because of it. The world's full of people that are beyond saving. What are you even... I also kind of like the aesthetic of like, apparently they'd shove like a deer antler through the zombie, and that's how like Aaron was steering it around, and it also had like pokey things out of its chest. But it's pretty fucked up for Aaron. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like Aaron went from about a 5 to like a 9 on the psychopathy scale this episode. You know, torturing people with, but we've seen like, you know, Rick's gone here. We've seen a lot of people fall from grace in this exact same way. So.
Do you think this scene also meant to tell us that Aaron has totally come to terms and is okay with having only one hand? Because he doesn't really look at this as a big deal of losing a hand.
Disability. Yeah. I think you might be onto something there.
Okay. Because I was thinking, God damn, you're going to cut off this hand? That's totally torture. That's horrible. Like,
yeah.
But then, yeah. I thought about that.
And from a storytelling perspective, I think this is also good because it's showing you how monstrous people can look from a different point of view. I mean, how is this different than the garbage people, you know, torturing Rick and Father Gabriel? How is this different than Negan, you know, putting people through the zombie gauntlet to manipulate them? How? And the answer is it's not, like, you know, except for in a means versus ends kind of way. But. Yeah. I think that's going to be another one of these storylines, is like how in instances where there's been so much death and pain on both sides, and maybe the people that are dealing with death and pain, you know, have some human reasons for that kind of shit, you know, hurt people, they say. I think that's another interesting angle they're stepping up for, as like who gets to throw the last stone?
Yes.
And how do you go from throwing stones to working and coexisting if you can't work together?
Yeah. That's a big step, a big transition, and I feel like Carol, of all people, is the one trying to make it here, because she's just gone down the other path. She's seen the cycles so many times now.
Yeah. I just wish I feel like there's a missing conversation or epiphany that Carol had to switch her from where she was at during the pandemic episodes to where she's at now. I feel like there was a little bit of a missing step.
Yeah, the soup didn't quite get me there.
No.
All right, Rosita helps Judith fix the handprint board. Eugene comes on the radio, but breaks up before they can really get any information conveyed. And then Redguard bursts into the room in the Commonwealth where Eugene is and arrests him. He's also got Zeke and Princess in tow.
So is this going to instigate the some more survivors from... So I'm trying to think, like, long-term what happens here. They got this... The one thing they got from Eugene is that he's someplace and he's safe.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't talk to him again, how long is it take before the Alexandrians decide to just, like, you know what, we're gonna do a voyage of faith, a caravan of courage. Mm-hmm. We're going to get some Ewoks together. We're going to walk in the direction of Eugene's friends because it's safe here and it's not there. I wonder if that's what they're kind of doing. Meanwhile, like, Eugene and his band might be banished, and now you've got a whole bunch of, like, you got a fucking caravan of refugees at the gates, and oh, what's that going to look like to mm-hmm. the Commonwealth folks? I see what some of the stakes are trying to set up here, and I'm interested in at least half of it.
Yeah, no, it seems a plausible path forward, because it seems pretty clear at this point that nothing is going to save Alexandria. They're buying time there is all they're really doing.
Yeah, I do. Like I said, I think they misplayed the Stephanie situation, because I did not get from, you know, their conversation with Eugene that she was committing a capital crime. Like,
mm-hmm. And she might not be if she's a citizen. I don't know. They don't ever tell us what the stakes are for her. Just that she's been charged with something.
She's got like a slap on the wrist versus maybe, you know, because I also don't know. Is this one of this? Because like the only time I can think of where I've heard, they've told a story like this and it's terrible. It's the season one episode of Star Trek where Wesley Crusher crashes through the greenhouse. And you've got a whole bunch of people like, well, what's the deal? Like, we'll fix the flowers. It's no versus you've committed a sin and you're going to die. Like, is it one of those places where all the crimes are capital? Essentially, if you all you got to do is follow the rules. And if you don't follow the rules, then you're fucked. I don't know. But if that's the case, then I feel like Stephanie should have been a lot more afraid. Yeah. And there should have been a lot less hijinks music out of Bear McCreary
for sure.
But yeah, maybe she doesn't know. Maybe she'll be horrified at how they treat immigrants into society. I don't know. They could go in that direction too, where there's a citizen resistance to the big brother.
Yeah, we'll see. And then Maggie continues to wait, and Negan begins packing food to take back to Alexandria. Maggie stops him, refuses to let him leave. And then Gabriel and some dude show up.
I think this is Casey Jones.
No.
Yeah. Inexplicably, no mask now.
What? I couldn't tell, man. I almost went. I didn't have time because we're like really tight on time this week. But I wanted to go back and look and see if it was him, because I thought that could be the case. But
I'm pretty sure.
Well, then my Judas theory. I don't like that. What about my Judas theory?
What about your Judas theory? I don't know. I think it is. But now my thing is like, okay, your Judas theory, but like my suspension of disbelief. This guy's never said more than a single line of dialogue. Maybe when he took his mask off for Kelly, never seen without his mask.
Mm-hmm.
And he pops up like, I thought he was grievously injured, and he pops up unharmed, no mask. Him and Gabriel have had to. Are we going to get a flashback episode of him and Gabriel, like you know, talking and all that kind of stuff? Because
I don't know. The way I remember him getting captured is he just gets sort of roped, like lassoed, and then pulled into the sky, and he drops his weapon, which Maggie throws later. So, if they captured him and he's weaponless, how did he get away? Like, none of that seems to line up. If this is in fact Casey Jones. I hope it's not, for multiple reasons, but we'll see. They all agree that they should just wait for more people to show up. I guess. I don't know who else is out there that we haven't seen yet. Probably. Are they waiting on Daryl? Is that who they're waiting on? I guess that's Daryl, it.
Well, there's a tension is that they left Boston Rob at the church. Uh-huh. So it's like they can't just wait infinitely for everyone to show up, because Boss and Rob will die.
True. Like, yeah. Nobody's making that point though.
I know. Like, it's all about, like, hey, we're not here by the darkness, and I'm getting the fuck out of here because it's giving the reboot. Like, yeah, you also have, and they mentioned, because, like, when Gabriel shows up, he's like, well, we got Boss and Rob doing here, and we're still waiting for Daryl and somebody else. I don't know. I didn't catch that guy's name. It's someone they haven't, like, established as someone I should care about yet. But.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, we'll see where that goes. Then we got one final scene where Eugene's group, at the Commonwealth, where Eugene's group are told what they're being charged with. They plead to little effect. And the guy from the orientation video then comes in with Stephanie and says not to move them. And then he goes to find someone named Mercer. Is Mercer? Mercer's not the red guard.
He's the big tomato red guard guy.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, he goes to find him for some reason. Is he like the ultimate authority here? But what about Milton?
I think that he is the one in charge of their incarceration. Like, if the Better Call Saul here can finesse Mercer, then he can start this before he can stop this before it becomes, like, you know, the judge's business and all that kind of stuff. So that's what I got. Gotcha. But like, this just, I mean, that's not canon. That's just how I interpreted things.
Stephanie tells them they might not be banished, but they will have to pay in one way or another.
Right. Like, so this guy's a fixer. He's extra legal, might be able to pull some strings, but now you're going to be, you know, I guess that's the other thing is, like, anytime you have these authoritative high control groups, you always have, like, a commiserate gray and black market for, you know, getting shit done.
Yeah, for sure. I do think one thing this probably tells us is that Stephanie has told this guy about Alexandria, because why else would he? Well, Eugene hasn't said too much, or no, he has. He spilled a lot of beans about Alexandria, didn't
he? Yeah, but he did say stay strong too. Like, he didn't say, like, we have this massive compound with a whole bunch of people wait. Like, he
told location.
Did tell a lot about, like, himself and meeting Stephanie, but he did not really betray the size or location of Alexandria. So,
well, I'm thinking, like, what did he tell Stephanie on the radio? Because before they knew that Stephanie was his contact here, he was trying to meet, I guess that doesn't matter, but now it does. Because she could tell whatever he told her to Mercer or whoever.
But I feel like that they were both being cagey. Like, they were telling a lot of truth about each other and their personal preferences and stuff. But they, you know, she was being cagey about her group. Obviously, she didn't mention, hey, well, I live in a city of 50,000 people with thriving electricity and ice cream and so many surgeons we have in baking cakes. And he didn't say, oh, by the way, I live behind these strong steel walls with, you know, electric solar power and all this other stuff. So, like, I feel like they know a lot. They told a lot of stuff about themselves, but not about the group. And that's how they kind of you know, made it okay.
I guess my question is then, why is Hornsby trying to pull any strings for these people?
Because what is Stephanie telling? I don't know. Like, you know, why does anyone do anything for a criminal? Probably for their benefit. You know.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder if this Hornsby guy is kind of like, you know, the Godfather. That, like, if you know, if you can get the things done within the rules, then yeah, go see the governor. But if you're up against the red tape and you might want to cut some corners in exchange for a favor, which may, you know, they may never come where I ask for that favor. But if I do, it's your it could be like one of those deals.
If you've baked this guy like 50 cakes and he still says you owe him one more cake every time. But you need that guy to disappear. Maybe as a wedding gift, you get to disappear somebody.
Yeah, when Yumiko's brother ruins his boy's birthday cake and he comes to you and is like, look how they massacred my boy's cake. You have to bake him a new one. No questions asked.
Right.
Use all your skills as a lawyer. Use all your skills as a lawyer and a high school teacher to bake me this cake.
We've got one more scene.
Can't let the boy's mother see the cake like this.
Where Carol gives the Whisperer some food and packs to leave. And then Keith says they saw Connie near the cave. Aaron says she can wait. Let's go back to Alexandria. We'll look for her at first light. Weird way to end an episode.
Yeah. And Carol's already like, I don't know. Here's the thing. It's like, it's interesting because Carol now wants to single-mindedly pursue her objective, right?
Yeah, oh,
if I can rescue Connie, then, like, man, it's like almost as all is forgiven. There's just,
right?
Right?
Just the hilltop, but you know.
Right, just a hilltop and all your friends and family that we right. had to re-murder, by
Troy,
the way.
Troy, who they had to murder earlier.
But yeah, she's like on tears and like, oh, please don't go down this path. It gets all fucked up when your personal objectives and emotion gets involved. Oh, Connie's alive? Yeah. Oh, my salvation. Yeah, it's and that might be intentional. They actually could have that kind of tension in the story, which would be kind of cool. Or it could just be we're on a weird morgalizing treadmill with these two.
Yes.
And it's going to be tedious. Hasn't got there yet. We'll see.
Yeah.
That's the one thing about the Kang era. There's been some stupid shit in isolation, but longstanding things that just get on my fucking nerves have been fewer and far between.
That's true. That's true. All right. That's it. That's all I got for the episode.
Yeah. Got a small satellite pack of Whisperers, a breakoff faction of perhaps good neutral Whisperers. I'm really curious to see what they end up doing with that.
Are they living a funny visual at Hilltop kind of lope. Now?
Yeah, like as soon as our team walked away, they just kind of like melted back into the woods, you know, or from the woods, and it just came from everywhere. So
yeah,
it's weird because only one of them's actually whispering. I guess that's how they did it, though, right? They'd have the people that are kind of hurting, and then, you know, in some other place, people were without their masks on and kind of like doing, you know, their thing. So I guess this is like the burnt out Hilltop is a massive upgrade from the open shit pits that they used to come eating worms and things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. We'll see. Also, I'm also very curious about what they could possibly find at the rendezvous point that's going to be that they can personally carry back on their four backs. It's going to change the tide of Alexandria.
Yeah.
This feels like I feel like because of the ambiguity and how they told the story, like, I don't know. This Maggie's rescue mission seems supply mission seemed stupid when it was on the outset, and it just keeps getting dumber. And I hate the fact that I'm on Negan's side every step of this. Like, it seems like he's always talking smart and she's always talking stupid.
Yeah. I mean, maybe when they get to Meridian, there are a lot of vehicles or something. Maybe she knows that they'll have the capacity.
Oh, tons
to carry
of vehicles fully
back,
gassed but... up and tons of food and the,
well,
you know,
horses fully gassed
and
up.
The Reavers just let it be. There wasn't enough Reavers to eat. You know, there's only like 13 of them whatever they said. Reavers. So just not enough to eat a full Alexandria's portion of it. Yeah. I don't know. They're little painting themselves in a corner, but hey, maybe they can get out of it. We'll see.
Also, well, they're going to take him back to a completely non-fortifiable Alexandria. So why? What's the point?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that'll do it for this week. We'll be back on a regular schedule of a feedback episode. If you got something burning that you want to talk about, save that for Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/baldmove. We'll record our feedback response episode live. The podcast will be out later that evening. And then, of course, this weekend at 9 p.m. or thereabouts, we'll have the latest episode of The Walking Dead for you to enjoy. We'll see you back next week. Until that time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.